we are able, through active machine learning, to efficiently provide a report to the partner that says, these are the compounds that are most likely to work should you move them to the clinical trial.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is about optimizing oncology drug discovery, development, and clinical using artificial intelligence. Now, drug discovery and development in clinical, they're very costly and time-consuming parts of getting a drug to market. And unfortunately, in many pharmaceutical companies, the processes haven't changed significantly despite all the advances in artificial intelligence. Today, I'm with Pamela Bush, the Chief Business Officer for Predictive Oncology, a science-driven company on the leading edge of oncology drug discovery, who offer an unrivaled suite of solutions to the biopharma industry using artificial intelligence. I'm so happy to have you on the show, Pamela. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with you telling me a little bit about your background, how you got into this, where you started, you know, how you got into this space.
Of course, my pleasure. So my name is Pamela Bush, and I am Chief Business Officer for Predictive Oncology. I am a scientist by training. I went to school and studied molecular biology and genetics and absolutely fell in love with science, but quickly realized that I wanted to be on the business side of science. So through different connections, I was able to get my first job out of graduate school and work for an organization in Pittsburgh that was looking to jumpstart the life sciences ecosystem in southwestern Pennsylvania. So I got a chance to meet with a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of professors from universities that had a fascinating technology that they wanted to commercialize and improve human health. And through there, I made additional connections and realized that I very, very much enjoyed being on the business side of science. I was able to translate science to non-scientists. I was able to translate business to the scientists so that we can start forming that ecosystem. And through different connections and through different opportunities, I ended up going from there to work at a big pharmaceutical company, Eli Lilly and Company in Indianapolis. And I worked in different roles in finance and corporate business development, which is where I wanted to be able to have an impact on the portfolio of the company and the molecules that were going to be someday developed into medicines. And I absolutely loved it. I loved the chance of interacting with entrepreneurs that wanted their technologies to be developed by big pharma, and the opportunity to also have technologies that were no longer going to be developed by Eli Lilly to be developed by other organizations, because there was also an opportunity to bring life to those opportunities. So I absolutely loved it. And through just life, I ended up moving out of Indiana, and I started my own consulting firm helping small companies do business development. Again, my passion has always been building that bridge between scientists and non-scientists and making sure that the right technologies get to market. And this opportunity to join Predictive Oncology came along about 2 years ago almost now, to join a company that was doing something that has not been done before. And that is to be able to incorporate the testing of how a drug would behave in a population of cancer patients at a preclinical stage. So we can go into more of those details, but I found it fascinating. It was very much in line with where my passion and my mission is. So I came here, and I'm working now to find the right biopharma partners that can leverage the technology and the platform that we have.
How long has predictive oncology been going? Did it just start when you joined, or was it already going for a while?
So predictive oncology has been, in one form or another, been around for a long time, but the company has evolved. Yeah. And it was not until the beginning of 2022 that we had the proof of concept for this platform. And that's when we were able to show that the platform and the active machine learning can actually do what we are expecting and what we're saying that it's going to do. The company started about 15, 20 years ago, and it was a different company. But thanks to the work that they did then, it has allowed us now to have this opportunity to leverage and utilize these vast collection of tumor samples that we have. So the company back then was a chemosensitivity company, and they were looking to help oncologists determine the best course of treatment for patients. So the oncologist would send a sample at the time of surgery from a patient, a piece of the biopsy, mm-hmm. and it was received by the company, and it was tested against different standards of care and different chemotherapeutics to see if the patient cells would respond or not to that chemotherapeutic. And then that data was stored, part of that tumor was stored, and a report was sent to the oncologist to then determine the best course of treatment for the patient. So this went on for several years. The company did not make it with that business model, but this rich collection of samples and the data behind it is the basis of the platform that we have.
I read actually that you've got over 150,000 samples of tumors. That's pretty impressive.
It is impressive, and it is accurate. We have over 150,000 samples. It covers over 137 tumor and subtumor types. We have more of some than others, but we have hundreds of each of them, which makes it more than enough to be able to design campaigns for each of the partners, regardless of what is the indication that they're looking to investigate and learn more about.
Very interesting. And so what does predictive oncology do with that data currently?
Okay. So what we do is we have the data, as I said, that was generated at the inception of the company and with the original business model. We have drug response data against standard of cares for each of these samples. Mm-hmm. We also have the samples that are frozen. These are fresh samples that have been frozen that can be brought back to life. And they're representative of the tumor sample that was received. So it's not just one type of cell. It is a representation of what we received from the original tumor.
Yeah.
So what we do is we partner with companies that are looking to advance their oncology pipeline. And it can be in the preclinical stage, it can be in the early clinical stages. And the bottom line of what we are able to give to the company is a insight into what would be a leading indicator of clinical success. Meaning it is a decision-making tool to decide which compounds to move into clinical development that are going to be more likely to be successful. Because what we're doing is we are incorporating the data that is available about these compounds, basic information like the structure of the compound, mm-hmm. and the machine learning engine that we have looks at that structure of that molecule and compares it against all of the molecules that have been tested in each particular tumor sample. So if you imagine a two-dimensional grid in which you have tumor samples on the y-axis and you have compounds, novel compounds or competitor compounds or standard of care compounds on the x-axis, and you have 100 and 100, that is about 10,000 different combinations.
Yeah.
So you could do all of those experiments. You can test each of those drugs against each of those samples. But in reality, the majority are going to not work, yeah. right? They are not going to be the right combination. So we are able, through active machine learning, to efficiently provide a report to the partner that says, these are the compounds that are most likely to work should you move them to the clinical trial. So we are able to predict which are the ones that are going to be hits, meaning the cells respond to the drug, and which ones are going to be misses.
Yeah.
And what's important is that if you imagine that you're testing a collection of compounds, say that you want to test them in 100 samples of breast cancer, these are actual patient samples of breast cancer. They're all going to behave slightly different. So you can see which of your 100 compounds that you're thinking about moving is going to have an impact in most of those tissues, right? Because it is really hard to develop a drug that is going to work on a very, very small, say 7% of the samples. But if you can find what is the drug that is going to work in 50% or more, then there's excitement and there's a more likelihood that those results are going to translate when you get into a clinical trial and you're going to be able to see that the drug actually has the effect that it should have in a patient clinical trial.
So you're coming in really early at this stage, aren't you, with the pharma companies?
Yes, we are working with pharma before a candidate selection has been made, before that decision to move it into the clinic. Yeah. That is a very key and thoughtful decision that is made by pharmaceutical companies. And a lot of effort goes into that. So the tools that we are able to provide and the information and the data that we're able to provide to a partner is it's a portfolio management tool. It is a commercial decision tool. It is a decision-making tool that gives them the insight of which are the molecules that are going to have the highest probability of clinical success when it actually is encountered by patients.
This would actually change the game in many ways because you have so many that fail at that early stage that cost a lot of time and money and effort, whereas doing what you're doing, that basically shortens that time and finds the failure, which is going to fail and which are going to succeed, just so much faster.
Absolutely. And that is the other side of the coin, right? It is not only finding which ones are the ones that are going to be successful, but which are the ones that are not going to be successful. Or in addition, finding what it would be the right drug to tumor combination strategy. Are you finding a better signal in lung and breast, but not so much in pancreatic? Yeah. And you can design your trials and you can power your trials to be maybe shorter to by requiring less number of patients because you know maybe what is the genetic makeup of these cells or the tumors that respond. We can work to help design all of that information ahead of time.
How much time does that save your clients? Do you have any idea?
We do not have the long prospect and that data yet. We look to be able to have that, but we are going to be saving them at least a few months. And when you think from a biopharmaceutical company, what is the value of 6 months? The way that I think about it is those are 6 months of peak sales. So anything that you can add to being able to commercialize it early so that you can then have those peak sales during a patent or while it's still under patent is incredibly valuable. But
absolutely. If you've got a really, blockbuster kind of level of sales, each day is 9 million. So it can be a huge amount of money.
Absolutely. Yes.
And so I'm thinking there's lots of different applications in that early phase. What other sorts of things do you do with pharma in the clinical side?
So on the clinical side, so let's say that a molecule has already been moved into the clinic. And you may want to expand and understand what are the tumors the tumor types that you want to go after. Or you have already gone after tumors, but you are not finding what is what are the markers that actually correlate to that response. Because we have access to those tumor samples and we can actually grow the cells, there's a lot of omics testing that can be done so that you can identify what is similar among the tumor samples that responded and what is different from the ones that did not respond. Because then you can tailor your trials to be in line with what we are expecting to be the responders. Of course, it doesn't take away from having to do the safety and the toxicology and still running the trials, of course.
Yeah.
but you might be able to power them differently. You might be able to design them differently. You might be able to have a tumor strategy that is more efficient, that allows you to go out with maybe that first indication that is going to get you to marker, to market while you are working on other supporting, maybe bigger indications.
Yeah. And where do you see pharma having the most uptake of your services?
Right now, it is going to be in that cusp of still in the preclinical stage before moving to candidate, but then also repurposing compounds.
Nice. Yeah.
So compounds that may have been taken into phase one, you did not find what was that optimal indication to go after or that population to go after. And then, but it is a compound that had a beautiful safety toxicology profile, and you want to identify, is there a smaller, maybe subset of tumor types or cancer profile that would be the right to move into? And we have the information to be able to select some of those samples and test it in vitro very quickly. Because one of the things that I did not mention earlier is the way that the platform works is we do that prediction. We then, the engine tells us which are the predictions that it is less confident on. We run those tests in the laboratory. We actually take the specific combinations, a small fraction. We do those experiments and we feed that information back into the engine, and it learns from that.
Yes.
It learns from those data points, and it makes a new round of predictions. And this goes on and on. It's an iterative process. It takes about, depending on the campaign, it can take, say, somewhere between 10 and 20 rounds. These rounds are limited by the complexity of the assay, but let's say each of the assays takes a week to 10 days. So each of the cycles, it's pretty quick. So within only a few months, you are able to see which are the drugs that are worth investigating more about and deciding which ones to move further along in development, because you have that supporting data that it is likely to be working in a heterogeneous population of samples.
Yeah. And I'm sure you don't need any extra data, but do your clients ever bring you additional data to use?
So the beauty of our engine is that it works very well with incomplete data.
Okay.
So there's a lot of deep data that is needed for a lot of artificial intelligent platforms and models. We don't need deep data. So we, the way that this has been designed is the engine, it is telling us what is the data that is needed, what is the data that it needs to make those decisions. The one thing that we absolutely need, or that the system needs, it can be blinded to us, we don't need to see it, is the actual structure of the molecule. So that one is a given. But other than that, there might be data that they have generated that they may have for maybe 10 of the compounds, but not for the other 10. We'll take that information, and the engine is going to use it if it sees that that information is needed to make the next round of more informed, higher confidence predictions. But it is not necessarily all of it needed.
Yeah, because you've got so much.
we do have a lot of data, and we generate each cycle the data that that the engine is telling us is needed. We'll generate that data. But it is a small percentage of that. So it is efficient and it is faster than running, in the previous example, all 10,000 combinations. That would take a lot of time and a lot of resources.
Absolutely. And has in the past, for sure.
Absolutely.
And could you maybe give me a case study of one of your clients, you know, what they were doing before and then what they're doing now since they've been working with you?
Yes. So right now, a lot of the decisions made to move compounds further in development is done early on in screens that use cell line, right? So these are immortalized tumor cells that have been passed on and passed on and passed on and may have lost some of their original genetic makeup. And it is interesting that a lot of the decisions that are made about compounds that have moved in development are the molecules that actually worked on the original screening cell line. The one of the things that actually, and I'm going to be diverting a little bit from your question, and I'll get back to the question, is imagine if there are compounds that did not work in that original cell line, but that would have worked on, say, 40 out of the 50 other tumor samples that you could have tested in, right? You just chose the one cell line or the one tumor sample that it didn't work on. So what are the compounds that are out there that could still be developed that worked on a different combination? So that to me is something that I'm looking forward as time goes by to be able to see how that works. But we don't have any data on that. That is just aspirational from my perspective. But back to your question about what is changing. So a lot of the screens are done in a single cell line. And then when they go down to a smaller number, there are companies that have cell lines that can be used to screen the compounds and determine what are the best compounds to move forward. But nobody has access to the rich data and primary tumor samples like we do. And we have done the research, and as far as we can tell, we are the largest privately held biobank of samples like this. Nice. So something that our clients are doing that has not been done before is incorporate that, or the opportunity to incorporate that tumor heterogeneity that the compound would not see. The compound would not be challenged until it gets to clinical trial. So we are kind of bringing the end result of a clinical phase three, for example, of which ones worked and which ones didn't. We're able to bring that insight into much earlier in the decision at a cost, as you can imagine, of a fraction of what it would be to run the full clinical development.
For sure.
So the way that I explain this is I always think of the output of our campaigns as it's a two-dimensional grid, as I said, of which ones worked and which ones didn't. And I always compare it to the game Battleship. I don't know if you've played Battleship.
Yeah.
So I always imagine that this is an opportunity to see your opponent's ship placement before the game begins, right? where are they, and which ones are going to be the easy hits, and where are going to be the misses? So this is the change that our platform can bring into how clinical development is set up and designed to be the most efficient and the most likely to be successful at the end, because as we all know, it's the patients that are waiting, and we want to get the medicines to market as soon as possible. So that's what drives all of that.
It's actually helpful for two things. It's the most important, getting the drugs that the patients need to market soonest, but also helping pharma be more efficient and get to, you know, that whole getting to market piece is so costly and time consuming, which, you know, translates into higher drug prices because it costs so much. Whereas doing anything that can shave time and cost off that is going to help everyone, including the patient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you would have known right at the beginning of starting a phase one that the likelihood of that drug is double the likelihood that you would have thought, or it is half of it, what are the different decisions that you would make, right? Yes. You maybe would put additional funding to jumpstart it and do it faster, or you may cancel a program. So any clinical studies in my mind that pharma doesn't have to run is not only saving time, but maybe if you could have two molecules that have a higher probability of success, maybe you double up and you invest in another one. Therefore, the likelihood of having two drugs at the end is higher than what you would have started with. So there's a lot of opportunities to do more efficient portfolio management. So it is not just the speed, but it is the strategy behind how you manage the funds that you have so that you have more compounds that are commercialized that is going to benefit our partners, biopharma, as well as patients.
Yeah. And what's your pricing model? Is it subscription or is it by project, or how does that work?
It is by project. It is by, we call them campaigns when we set up the campaign. Mm-hmm. And one of the benefits that we are giving to our clients is the benefit of seeing what are the molecules that are most likely to succeed, right? And we want to share on that upside with our partners. Mm-hmm. But the other valuable part that we are giving to the clients is stay away from these ones. These ones, the ones that are not going to be working, and there's great value on that.
Absolutely.
At the end, our partner is going to be deciding which ones are the molecules that are working on and are not going to be working. So the way that we set up our partnership is through the sharing of the upside on the molecules that are successful when they get to market and then when they get commercialized and as they move along in development.
Nice. I like that. And so what's next for Precision Oncology? Where do you see yourself going in the next few years with the company? Where do you think it's taking?
So right now, I am working tirelessly to bring this message to biopharma, because one of the things that I'm noticing is drug development has been done pretty similar with some changes along the way, right? Maybe there used to be one cell line, now there's 100 that they can screen it with, or some things that are adding some efficiency. But this is kind of changing a little bit. It's disrupting the way that it's being done because we're bringing data, mind you, it is in vitro data, but yeah, it is giving you an insight of what that clinical, it's a leading indicator of performance in the clinic, yeah, right? So that's disrupting it. So right now it's bringing that understanding to our potential partners and looking to work together and create campaigns that are going to inform their pipelines. We're also, right now, we're mostly focused on small molecule, and we're working to incorporate now large molecule, because it is not just drug response. Any measurable assay or a difference in a measurable assay can be incorporated as part of the information that is fed into the platform. So now we're expanding and looking to expand to larger molecules, and then also moving to combinations, because as we all know, oncology treatment is usually not just a single molecule. So just looking at what combinations can be. So we're starting to set up those kind of campaigns to start looking into how that works.
It's very exciting. And so are your clients global or mainly in America?
Right now, actually, our first partner is actually a partner in the UK. It is Cancer Research UK. Their research arm is Cancer Research Horizons. So we are working with them on the campaign for one of their programs that they have.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Congratulations. Yes.
So, thank you. So I would say it's global and there's no limitations as to where the company can be. This can be anywhere. As you can imagine, a lot of the data is securely transferred. Mm-hmm. And then it is just being able to ship the compounds so that we have them available for the wet lab experiments if needed. So that is not as complicated as other things. So it's pretty simple and straightforward to work across the globe.
Wow, really nice. I think that some of the listeners may want to get in touch with you after this. So for anyone listening who is interested in getting in touch with Pamela and her team, you can go to predictive-oncology.com. And you can see more about it and you can get in touch with them. And I just would love to thank you so much for being on the show, because it's fascinating and you really do have a knack of making very complex information very simple to understand. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.